Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Before we go to the verse, I'm going to talk just a little bit about the kind of the inner landscape and the, what goes on inside of us from a more of a understanding how Vedanta really looks at it. You know, very simply, Vedanta will just divide that inner landscape into your own presence and then the buddhi. Right? The buddhi means your intellect, the one that knows. I'll explain a little bit more about that in a minute. And then the manas, which is really the emotional mind. It's the one that is not decisive. But the, one of the best ways, really, and what we're going to be talking about now, is the manas as that emotional mind. And then we have the sense organs that, you know, the buddhi uses, and the mind in general uses, whether it's the buddhi or the manas, use the sense organs for external perception. And then we have the ahankara, the I notion, which is, the I notion is really a function of the buddhi, the intellect, which will come along and identify in one way or another with a thought in the mind, with your intellect, or with your emotional mind. Or it can also, the buddhi is where you really gain knowledge in terms of knowledge of the world, but also knowledge of yourself. The buddhi is responsible for viveka, for discrimination, for your being able to recognize in your experience, any given experience, you're able, for somebody who has self-knowledge or is gaining self-knowledge, you're able to identify and discern your experience properly so that the buddhi is actually able to recognize and properly label your own presence and also label the experiences that you have. So your presence is one thing. The experiences that you're having that are coming and going in your presence is, in a sense, initially, just to speak this way, is another thing. If the buddhi can recognize both my own presence, which has been differentiated from the things I'm experiencing, especially in the emotional mind, which is the mind that causes us problems. You know, if you're just experiencing the weather, you know, oh, it's not a problem. If you're using your sense organs to just objectively experience the world, that's not a problem for us. The problem is the emotional mind. And so now, in terms of our experiencing the world through our sense organs, I have a natural, just even without knowledge, I have a natural space between me, the one who's experiencing the objects, and the objects. There's a natural distance. I don't take myself to be the objects. If I'm looking at that painting, I have a definitely very clear subject-object relationship with the painting. I don't take myself to be that. And I can easily move myself away from physical experiences. I actually have the same type of subject-object relationship with any thought in my mind. With any emotion, it doesn't have to be a perception. It can be any type of an emotion, any type of a feeling, any type of a memory. You know, I know that I'm aware of the memory, or I'm aware of the emotion. I can say, you know, I can. I don't act like that. I can say, you know, I'm so sad. But if I were to say, "Are you aware of that emotion?" you would say, "Yes, I'm aware of that emotion." So there's a natural subject-object relationship, but we don't tend to always be in a subject-object relationship with our emotions, wherein I can do something about them. You know, usually, even though I'm aware of the emotion, I'm overwhelmed by the emotion. and therefore I become the emotion. Right? If I were aware of the emotion, you know, working with the emotion, then I can do something with it. If I can differentiate the emotion from my own self. Actually, I can do that as easily, in fact, as I can differentiate myself from objects, because it's exactly the same. The subject-object is exactly the same, but we don't notice it. We need to notice it. If we do notice it, if we can notice that this anger or this hurt or this rage or whatever it is that's going on inside of me is something that I can sit with and that I can be with, that I can be aware of, and that my buddhi, you know, the intellect, the one that is gaining knowledge, can differentiate between the tumultuous mind or the hurt mind, the overwhelmed mind, and my own presence, you know, then there's something, then I have some space. There's some inner space. And say I am, because of knowledge, I am able to differentiate my own presence, you know, illumining and present to the tumultuous or the hurting mind. Say I'm able to do that. If that is a fact, if I can do that, then there's another thing I can do. And that is that the ahankara, my ahankara, the I notion, and now instead of being a notional created I, the I notion, the I can resolve into me, the one that is illumining the emotional mind. And if I've made the differentiation between myself and the emotion that's taking place, and then the I notion comes, the ahankara comes, where is it going to land? It has a choice now. That's what I'm saying. It has a choice. If I haven't made that differentiation between my being, you know, and the emotion that I'm experiencing, if I haven't made the viveka, the differentiation, the ahankara has no short choice. All it can say is that I am upset, because the I and the upset are one and the same. There is no space. See, there's no space. So then what does it do, this I, now that I'm upset? Why am I upset? And I have to look for the reasons, and I don't have any place to go internally to be held, right? Because there's nothing to hold me, because I am upset. So I have to look out here. You see what I mean? If the I and the upset are one and the same thing, who's going to hold me? Really?
Stuck.
You're stuck there, right? But what if the I, the self, that illumining presence of me, has been differentiated from the upset? Then the I goes to me, and the upset emotion is something that is taking place that I am illumining. This is the buddhi knows. The buddhi makes this differentiation. It recognizes it. Then what happens is that your buddhi, the intellect, as the ahankar, can identify with me. And then if I'm doing some sort of what I sometimes I call inner friend or inner child work, that buddhi that has identified with me, the stable myself that's illumining it, that illumines all the experiences, then this buddhi will now hold the experience. So say the experience is one of anger or hurt or agitation or feeling unloved or all of the hurtful types of emotions that all of us can have, you know. Then now the buddhi can come into relationship with that feeling of hurt and feeling of being unloved in a way that is meaningful, in a way that in fact is what you are asking for from the world. If the identification with your presence and the emotional hurt is just an identification of I am hurt, then I am suffering, and I need someone to help me, to hold me, to soothe me, to make me feel better, to tell me that I love you and I think that you're a wonderful person, you know. Whatever. But if that's what we need. We need to be loved, you know, and we need to know that, that we're respected and that we're a good person and we're not the only one. And it's not just me that sees that. We all know, you know, this is a thing. We all know inside that I am a good person, that I'm doing my best. I mean well. I'm really trying. We all know this, you know. But we don't know that others know that. And so we feel, can have all kinds of feelings around that. So that feeling that that you know, that's a, I think this is one reason why Swamiji's, you know, it's just so healing to be around Swamiji, because when you're around him, he exudes that. He exudes that toward you, that you are a wonderful person and I really like you, you know? And that you are a good person. Oh, you're having this little problem. That's all it is. We'll just get rid of that. That's not a problem. But that's not you. He sees right through to the core in such a visceral way, you know, that you are a good person and you're doing the best you can, and this little problem we can take care of. You know, there's that love and respect. This is what we need. And we can't always get it from out here because everybody else is having their own problems. Mm. And they need love and respect, you know, and knowing that you know that I'm a good person, you know. Everybody needs it. So now, if you understand that, that that's kind of what the human heart needs, maybe the human heart needs that because, in fact, that is your nature. That's the nature of your own presence that's abiding amidst all the tumultuous emotional mind that's been hurt in this way or that way or this way or that way. So now, when we do this type of inner friend or inner child work, what is actually happening inside is that your intellect, that I call the buddhi for those, that's the Sanskrit term for it, the buddhi. Once it's made that, had that viveka where it now recognizes the constant presence of my being, the natural, simple wholeness, you know, of me, once it's made that differentiation, then it, identifying with that, becomes the inner friend to the emotional mind. And it's that one that can be present to the tumultuous mind that is going crazy in this way or another, or so upset about this or so upset about that. That buddhi can be a friend to that mind. If the buddhi can be a friend to that mind that is in pain or acting out in this way or that way or starting to feel more, and when you're in pain and raging and acting out and hating everybody, you know, when you get into a space like that, you become more and more and more isolated. The mind gets itself into a deeper and deeper and deeper pit. But if you have that ability to do that viveka, then you can always bring in a deep, the buddhi can bring in a deeper level. It can, let me put it this way, the buddhi can objectify whatever acting out is going on in the mind. If the mind is saying, you know, I hate you all and you're doing this to me, you know, the buddhi can say, look at what you're saying. You're saying I hate you all and you're doing this to me. Right? You become aware of that. The mind can be feeling sad. The buddhi then can be overwhelmed by the sadness and then be saying, I am sad. And then the buddhi, just because of the nature of the mind, because the self is always there, the buddhi can then objectify that and say, you're saying you are sad, but you're forgetting about me. See what I mean? There's no end to the objectification. So no matter how angry or how upset or how I'm sorry you're feeling for yourself, or all of the whole gamut of things that we can go through, there is always a buddhi there who can either be swallowed by the emotion, right, and then say, I am that, or it can speak from the standpoint of the self, because it also recognizes the self. The self illumines it, and it recognizes that stable presence. So if it can speak from that stable presence of me, then it can hold, it becomes an inner friend to the emotional mind. If it's an inner friend to the emotional mind, whatever hurts are going on inside of me, then those hurts have an environment in which they can settle down. They're not alone. It's very, very tough for a mind that is alone. And alone means it's the buddhi is identified with it. The I is identified with it. And so then I am that emotion. There's no one internally that's holding it. And so then you're angry, become very, very, very angry and hostile to the world, because you're not, you can dig yourself deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper into a hole. Eventually you have to, the mind gets itself, can get itself into such a state that it has to cry it out or just give it up because it can't survive anymore. But this this stops it from getting into such a desperate state. You know, and we're capable of desperate states, depending on your childhood and, you know, what type of experiences you have had. The minds are capable of getting into very desperate states. To gain knowledge, if you're getting self-knowledge, you have to also learn, you know, how to handle the mind in the light of your knowledge. How to be with that mind, you know. Because if the mind was no problem, then we wouldn't have any trouble, right? There'd be no problem. That's not the case. It's very, very, very unusual in this tumultuous era, you know, in the entire world I'm talking, for the mind not to be capable of getting into very tumultuous states. But if you have a self, then those tumultuous states, as long as they're there, are taking place in the presence of someone whose nature, which is the very nature of the Atma, is naturally accommodating, naturally whole, naturally peaceful, not getting frayed by your tantrum. You know? So you can be exploding all over the place and yourself is just fine. It accommodates you. And if the buddhi understands and can come from the standpoint of that self, it can be really, really a good mother. Really a good parent. You know, what every child needs is, you know, a parent who's stable in the presence of their freak out. You know, I've told the story before, but I had these friends who I went to school with. This one man is a psychologist, my age appear. And he was over at their house for dinner, and they just had a little baby. The baby was so tiny. It must have been 3 months old. Just the cutest little boy. And so he got wet, and so the mother took him upstairs to change his diapers and whatnot, and I went with her. And this little guy was so upset. She laid him down in the, you know, the diaper, where she had a special place to change his diaper. She laid him down, and he was screaming. His whole body, little body, was turning red, and his face was red, and his mouth was open as wide as it could possibly be, and he was just beside himself. And here she was with her little boy having this dinner. "You are so upset, sweetie. It'll be okay." And she was just, you know, she was so calm and so loving as he was carrying on and on, and she was changed. "Oh, I know you don't like your diaper change. It's going to be okay." And, you know, and slowly, slowly he was calming down. But the rage he was in was total. It couldn't have been more. And I was just watching this, and I was just watching how much she loved him, and she was just taking care of And she was identifying with him and how upset he was, and it's going to be over in a minute, it'll be okay, honey, you know. That was so sweet. And I just watched that rage, you know, slowly subside in kind of the peace, that stable peace of the mother, you know. And then she picked him up. Finally, she got his diaper changed and picked him up and was holding him with so much care and so much love. And he became fine, and then he was sleeping, and that was all. Yeah. But the tantrum was total. It was total. And our minds are capable of those kind of tantrums, you know, those kind of deep, deep hurts. You know, and so you have to be like that to that mind. And that's what it needs. It doesn't need any less than that. Mm-hmm. You know, what if the buddhi has not... This is a little psychology, but it's important to try to understand to get this, because I think it makes a difference in how you deal with yourself internally. The buddhi has whatever knowledge it has, you know, and the knowledge also, and the knowledge is also just based a lot on your experience, especially your growing up experience. So say your mind, the manas, is feeling some sort of depression or feeling down, and it has the buddhi which identifies with that depression and says, I am depressed, you know. But then there's another way that the buddhi will split, and now it'll say, you're always depressed. It'll type two things: I am depressed, where it identifies with the depressed state. And then it makes a comment on the depressed state. So here, first at the manas comes up, here's this emotional state, depression, which is a hard state for people to be with. So the ego, the ahankara, comes and says, I am depressed. You know? And then how do you feel? Then that evokes the buddhi's comment on that. You know? Now, where is the buddhi getting its repertoire of comments, you know, from how people talk to you when you grew up, basically. So, say you're depressed, and your parent said something like, say if you had a stern parent, there you are moping again. Okay? Say the parents like that. There you are moping again. Okay? Now you say, as an adult, I am depressed. What is the next thing you say? There you are moping again. Right? And so now, that little child that's saying I was depressed becomes more depressed. See what I mean? Because the way the inner voice, the buddhi, is dealing with it is punitive. It's not, you know, I love you and respect you and like you and I'm glad you're here. It's not that at all. Mm. You know? It's there you are, you little creep, you're depressed again. Yeah. So this is what we call this like inner talk, you know, how we talk to ourselves. And that the buddhi is often taking on the guise of the way you were talked to when you were little. You don't even notice it, in fact. And so when knowledge comes in, there's a lot of things that have to be sorted out in light of your knowledge. Because you have the ahankara, the I notion, that's identifying with the depressed state, the sad state, the hurt state. And then the buddhi also is taking on ways of responding, because the buddhi says, I am depressed. You know, it'll say, I am depressed. But then it will also respond to that state based upon how you've grown up. Do you see what I'm saying? But now what we need is somebody to come in and save the day. instead of the identification being with this, you know, negative parent figure, or whatever your childhood problems were, you need an inner friend. You need the buddhi that now has knowledge that can say to the one that, speak to the one who is saying, there you go being depressed again, you know, being able to say, no, you don't have to talk to yourself like that, That's how your mother used to talk to you. That's how your father used to talk to you. You don't have to talk to yourself like that. You know, you'll be fine. Bringing in a whole different attitude. But the attitude that's being brought in is based on ananda. It's based on the nature of yourself. See what I'm saying? It's based on the nature of yourself. It's based on your value system. It's based on dharma. It's based on how you would want to treat yourself, how you would treat your own child. So there's a lot of kind of inner consciousness, not consciousness in the sense of Brahman, consciousness of being aware of the dynamics that are going on in your own mind, just unconscious dynamics, you know? And it all has to do, of course, with a habitual and natural misidentification, where the conscious being is identified with the emotional state, and then also the self-talk that is something that is that you grow up with. And so the self-talk is also unconscious, like the critical voice or the demeaning voice, you know, the parent, the voice that doesn't respect you, the voice that doesn't love you, the voice that doesn't have confidence in you. All of those voices, usually people aren't even aware of them. That's just the environment that the mind is living in. If the mind is living in the presence of a critical voice, then it's going to be depressed. Wouldn't you be, you know? Or say you have somebody outside, all they do is complain about you all the time. Tell you this is wrong with you, and you're not doing this right, and, you know, you should have done this better, and, you know, you should have gotten a better grade than that. You know, all the time. You should be better, you should be better. You're not good enough, you're not good enough. You know? You're not pretty enough. You think you're too pretty. Whatever it is, but what I'm saying is this inner self-talk, does the inner self-talk, if it were out here coming at you from out here, how would you feel? Mm. You know, how would you feel? It's the thing. Would you feel like being here? Really, you just have to ask yourself that. Would you feel like being here? Would you look forward to coming here?
No, it's a terrible mirror.
It's a very painful mirror. And the thing is, we have that painful mirror inside. And so now what we need to do, and what we do, why meditation is so useful really, is we create an inner space where we can, the buddhi, can come into relationship with the atma, yourself. The self that is stable, the self that is changeless, the self that you can't, that is absolutely non-condemning by its nature, is absolutely accommodative by its nature. It's that your very being is what, in fact, we always try to push everything away. Say when you're meditating, what you want to do is just quieten everything, get everything away, just so that you can absorb yourself into the fullness and wholeness of your being. This being that you are has to come to the forefront, so that becomes the self of the buddhi. You see what I mean? The self of the buddhi. Then that self is a kind self. Not in terms of any type of action. The buddhi will act out of the kindness. But the self is kind. As its very swarupa, as its very nature, the self is kind. See what I mean? So you're... actually, your whole mind, your whole experience is being held in the non-dual kindness. Non-dual means it's not acting, it's just the non-dual ananda, the non-dual kindness of your being. So let the buddhi hold the rest of the mind, you know, identified with that non-dual kindness. And so that means, how will it be talking? It will be talking in a way that's kind, in a way that's accommodating, in the way that cares for you, because its nature is care, its nature is kindness, not caring. Caring is an action that requires the buddhi, but the caring comes from care. Care, when we used to talk like that, it's the very swarupa, it's your very nature, you know? And so let the buddhi talk to the negative inner voices, and the emotional mind in that way, and then it'll settle down. The mind can turn on a dime. You know, you can be so upset, and somebody can say just the right thing to you, and it just goes away. You know, so the mind is fluid. It's not, you know, like a table. So we need to learn how to. It's what we call Kaushalam. We need to learn how to actually be with the mind in such a way that we can turn it around like that. Or in such a way that when the mind is upset, you know, it has some place to go. Me. That my buddhi knows how to handle it, how to be with it. And when the buddhi knows how to be with it, that means it's coming from this standpoint of inner friend, which is my own presence. So meditation is such a good thing because it gives me a chance to let my own self come to the forefront and let the buddhi, you know, own me instead of the buddhi being totally over owning the mind. See, the ahankara can come and say, I am the mind, I am this emotion, you know, or I am hateful of this emotion. It's a totally in samsara. Or it can resolve itself in the truth of who I am. And then things are so totally different. Then I'm coming from that standpoint and I'm holding and taking care of the mind. So this is what we need to do. Right? So I'm going to do just, we'll do just a short meditation. Okay. I'm going to do a guided one. So let yourself get into a really comfortable position. Just feel the body. Let the body relax. Take some deep breaths. And if there's any tension anywhere in the body, just kind of gently, mentally massage that area. Be aware of it. And let your mind just be, let it relax. Whatever feelings or images, thoughts are there, just let yourself be. Be present to them and just accepting of the mind as it is. Mind is for any reason creating anger or pain for you. Don't push it away. Just acknowledge it. In fact, whatever the mind is doing, you can just breathe that in order that there not be any resistance at all. You just breathe it in, and then breathe out your own care. Just accepting and understanding. And if there's any anger there, just breathe that in. And breathe out your own care and understanding of why that is there. Notice your own awareness, just your own presence, accepting the body and the mind and whatever experiences you may be having. Still notice your own presence amidst all of that. You can breathe your body and mind into that presence. whatever else may be happening, just notice your own silent presence. Breathe in to it and breathe out from it. Let your mind and body be whatever they are, whatever feelings are there or not there. And just breathe into and out of your own presence. The mind needs to get used to noticing me, to being with me, to being cared for by me. To always come to me for the care and the comfort. or the unconditional love.
Thank you, that was such a good New Year reminder.
Happy New Year.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to keep bringing it home.
Yeah.
It's okay, Tibby.
You're a good mother.
That door's not shut, is it? The bedroom door? Is it open?
No, she's in.
Okay, good.
She's talking.
Just talking away. She always comes in and talks. let us all know she's here.
At one point you said that the Buddha was going to have a relationship with the self. So how does that happen? How does that... I mean, I'm used to hearing that the self really is non-active.
And, right.
So
by relationship, I mean, of course, it's a satya-mitya relationship, but I'm not going to talk on that level right now. As opposed to identity, see, the buddhi usually identifies the self with itself. So the buddhi will say, like this, the buddhi will say, I am the conscious being, and I am unhappy. Right? So that's identity. So whatever is going on in the buddhi, say that an emotion is there, for instance, in the manas, then the buddhi, which in the form of the ahankara says, I am unhappy. So now that's the buddhi has an identity, right? It identifies with itself, with consciousness, and with its own content. So I am unhappy, I am sad, I am agitated, I am happy. I am whatever the condition may be. In the mind, right? The buddhi takes the self to be that. That's identity. There's no relationship there. The buddhi, though, can recognize, this is knowledge, the buddhi recognizes that it itself is illumined. It recognizes that about itself, and it recognizes that it is always changing. It knows that about itself. And it recognizes that the self, you know, illumines it. The self is its very self, right? But the self doesn't change at all. The buddhi changes, you know, and reflects all of these changing conditions, emotional states, perceptions, everything is taking place in the buddhi. But the buddhi doesn't have a self when there's ignorance there. It is the self. It doesn't have a self. Right? So we want the buddhi to recognize that it has a self and that there is a difference in that the self, your being, is not changing, is not coming and going, is not touched at all by any emotional condition, any perception, any imagination, whatever is going on in the buddhi, whatever perceptions are there, whatever emotions are there, those are illumined by me, the self, pervaded by me, the self, but totally untouched. The self remains totally untouched. And so that has to be, that differentiation has to be there. You know, but it's not that the self is here and the mind is here. The self is here, the mind is here. But the self remains totally untouched by the changing, by the changes of the buddhi and the emotions of the buddhi. So if the buddhi can make that, have that viveka, then it now itself is in relationship to the self, not in identification with it. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then what happens is that as the buddhi recognizes that, because it's the buddhi that's gaining knowledge, right? The buddhi recognizes the pervasiveness of me, the changeless pervasiveness of me. By pervasiveness, it's a little misleading. It's kind of like saying how the clay pervades the pot. Really, the pervasiveness is total in terms of substance. So me, the conscious being, totally pervades and is the very self of the mind. It isn't affected by the mind. It doesn't change as the mind changes. It doesn't have emotional states. Right? The emotional states take place in me, but I'm not an emotional state. That's the relationship. There's the viveka, it's the differentiation. And so the solid, stable presence of me needs to come to the forefront. So whatever thoughts are going on, whatever moods are going on, whatever emotions are going on, are taking place in me, who I'm fine. That's the viveka, when I've differentiated my own presence from the changing states of mind. Now, there's many reasons why that's important. One is that I have a self. Otherwise, you don't have a self from the standpoint of the buddhi, because you're just changing all of the time. There's nobody home. There's nobody to come home to, you know. But what's so profound about it is that the nature of myself is ananda. It is so whole and full and complete. It is care itself. It is love itself, not loving as an action. But it's very swarupa. It's very, very nature is that. So there's nothing greater than that or more dear than your own presence. And so that dear presence comes more to the forefront. Not that it hasn't always been in the forefront, but for the standpoint of the buddhi, it's not in the forefront. The buddhi's so engaged in this thought or this thought, this emotion, that emotion, what so-and-so is doing over here, or this cause, that, it gets totally engaged in the web of samsara, trying to solve its problems. Whereas for a jnani, the buddhi is not so any longer so engaged in solving its problem. Staying home, you know, letting your being be at the forefront, then it's dealing with the prarabdha karma, really. The karma that is unfolding for your life. You know, the life that's unfolding for you. And you're doing the best you can with it. Yeah. Complicated. Life is complex. There's a lot going on. A lot of karmas going on. You know, complex karmas. Complex relationships within samsara. You know, good things and bad things and hard things. It's all in a jumble, all mixed together. You know? And if you're trying to sort all of that out so you can be happy, it doesn't work very well. You know, it really doesn't. It really doesn't work very well. The happiness, the mind has to discover the stable happiness in which the samsara takes place.
But isn't that a natural ambition of the mind to sort all this out? And make
oh yeah, it is. That's why it's such a rare thing to become a mumukshu. Because at some point, you know, your mind says, this is impossible. It is literally impossible to make this work. And you realize it, and another important thing that you're realizing, and it's not because I'm stupid, it's not because I'm inadequate, it's the nature of the beast. The creation cannot produce for you any type of lasting situation. You know, say for instance, just imagine, you get everything just right. The creation has, everything is just moved in a perfect way. And now here it is the moment, you know, where everything is perfect now. But that's only for the moment. The moment keeps rolling, right? The time keeps rolling. And so if you are maintaining your ananda, your fullness, as the time keeps rolling along, that is because your fullness is not dependent on that. If your fullness was dependent on it, as it rolls along, it would be going, right? Naturally. But that's what we call samsara. To whatever degree your wholeness is dependent upon, you know, the samsara, what's going on out here, to that degree you really suffer. And there's no exceptions. Bhagavan is grueling in that way. The truth is grueling. It doesn't say, well, I'll just make this not be true for you. It doesn't want to do it. You know? So there's no compromise. And I think, you know, we go on realizing it, that there is no compromise to this. And it's fine. You know, it's fine. That's how we learn. You know, you're driven to the truth. You're driven to it in a sense. In the end, I think in the end it comes down to Dharma and the self. And Dharma is just another way of saying Ishvara. Just a recognition of Ishvara's order in terms of Dharma, Adharma, and the minds. But even then, Dharma, Adharma gives you the understanding of Dharma in reference to Ishvara gives you a relative shanti. But even then, it won't give you complete shanti. The only thing that will give you complete shanti or complete wholeness is a wholeness that isn't subject to becoming unwhole. See, if you're whole, if you have a wholeness that is subject to becoming unwhole, then there's going to be fear. Because now you have to hang on to this wholeness. This is exactly samsara. Got everything just right. You have this moment of wholeness. Now everything is fine with me. I finally accomplished it. And then you lose it. Happens again, you lose it. Happens again, you lose it. At some point, you become a mumukshu. Because you realize that can't but be. And so then your question comes, well, is there any way that it can be? Is there any way that I can just be whole and complete and forget about it? Mm-hmm. Not have to be manipulating the world all the time or trying to hang on to it. Is there any such thing? That's what we call moksha, where I can just say I'm whole and complete, I'm done with it now, it's over. I don't have to worry about that. That's a non-issue now. Mm. Nobody's going to take that away. You know? And I can't even take it away from myself. That's moksha. Bondage is, I have this wholeness and completeness now, but how am I going to hang on to it? You know? That's samsara. But the only reason we have that all those fears is because, you know, the mind is capable of a shanta vritti, and it's capable of a very upset vritti also. The shanta vritti gives a moment of peace and happiness, and the upset vritti gives a moment of isolation or depression or sadness. And it goes like this. It's going like this all the time. It's like this, open in the shanta vritti, when my desires are being satisfied. And it's like this, you know, and the negative, when the desires are not being satisfied. Even internally in your imagination, like say in that kind of inner child work, what is causing the very upset emotions are when the overwhelming inner child feelings of not getting my needs met are up. If the little child, if there's any, that the little child, of course, if the little child were happy, that child would be integrated with your conscious mind. You know, it's the unhappy parts, the unhappy child parts that are kept in the unconscious, and so these very unhappy parts sometimes overwhelm the mind. They're happy parts, they're just growing along naturally, nothing's traumatized them, they're fine, you know. But it's the unhappy parts. And why are they unhappy? Well, their needs were not met in one way or another, you know. And what are basically the needs? It's basically, you know, feeling loved and liked and respected. You know, and so situations that make me feel that way, and I love those situations. And the situations that don't make me feel that way, we all want to leave them or escape them in one way or another. It's natural. Even in Shankara's Bhasha, his Adhyasa Bhasha of the Brahma Sutras, which is kind of has the whole Vedanta in these few little pages, he starts out by talking about a cow. If you hold some fresh grass up to a cow, it'll come trotting over, you know. If you hold a stick up to it, it'll run away in fear. Our whole life is like that, you know. Grass or stick, you know. And we're always, you know, seeking out and going toward that which gives us a shanta vritti, basically. And always trying to acquire it in one way or another. But what about when your mind knows that the source of the shanti itself is the self, and that's never away? That's because that viveka has taken place. And so then the mind seeks out the self, which is not away from it, for its fullness and for its ananda. And from that position, you know, experiences the world. That works. That works because the self doesn't come and go, you know. It doesn't run away, it doesn't disappear, it doesn't morph into something else. And that's moksha. Really, the self is the, when you say, oh, this person is liberated, what makes them liberated is that they've realized that their very nature is liberated, that the self is liberated. The mind is always changing, the body's always changing, samsara is always changing. But all of those changes are taking place in a self which is free. And that has been discerned, that I am free. And my mind is free. My mind is now free because it's recognized I am free. Right? But the mind is by its nature changing all of the time. But it's changing all of the time in a self that is free. And it can't change or hurt the self that is free. So the mind will say, I am free, talking about the nature of me, the conscious being, you know, recognizing my own nature. And then it has a home. That's what I, when I say relation, that's what I mean by relationship. If there's only identity there, there's no home. I have to find a home out here. You have to make me feel better. You know, I feel terrible. You need to make me feel better. Because I don't have, that mind doesn't have anyone inside, any nature, you know, ananda or wholeness inside that can hold it. So then I depend on the good, you as a good mother, you as a good friend, you know, you as a good therapist. Really, all of them. Even the guru-sisha relationship, you know. You depend on the teacher for that. At least I did for my teacher. I depend on the teacher for that. Until, you know, that transfers over to your own. It's the same in therapy, to depend upon your therapist for that holding until that takes place in you. There's a certain shift that takes place there.
What transfers again?
That sense of comfort of being like that there's somebody who is steady in their high, in their regard for you, steady in their care, steady in their friendliness, steady in their respect, steady in their love. It's not something that is going to be taken away. You know, it's still all real. That's all relative. But it holds the mind until you, in the end, recognize that which isn't relative. There's only one thing that is that, which is yourself. Bhagavan set it up, even though there's so many, there's unfortunate things that happen in the world for sure. But in this mother-child relationship for the infant, Bhagavan made it so there's so much chemistry that's going on that the holding care on the part of the mother is so constant, and it's so strong, it's even beyond the mother's own willpower. There's a transformation that takes place there. It's because the baby requires that, you know, the type of holding. It's so overarching. And then there's another thing, that the baby itself is so cute. They're so cute, you know, that they would drive you crazy, but because it's 24/7, but they're so darn cute, you know, that all they have to do, they can be carrying on, but that just those sweet little smiles and these little bones that they toss you, you know.
Oh, you can't stay away.
You can't stay away. No. It's an amazing, it's such an amazing thing. I only knew it secondhand from an aunt as being an aunt, but at least I got to be a good aunt. But it's an amazing thing. I've seen it. Bhagavan has to provide a container that can allow some relative holding, you know, that can allow the child to develop kind of a stable internal self-structure. He has to make it happen, you know. You can see it even with animals. Animals with their young. It's the same incredible bond. So, you know, it just shows, so creatures, we're creatures also. We're animals also. We're all the same in a certain way. All animals, and there are certain things that are the same. And they all enjoy the same self. You know? It's all Ishwar. They all are the same self.
Also, the you know, the changelessness of myself, that makes it safe. I mean, there's a question of safety as well. You know?
Safety, yeah, absolute safety. Because nothing can happen to it. You can't do anything to it, neither can anybody else. That's also very comforting to know if your mind goes off on a rampage of sorts. You know, nothing's happening to yourself. You're fine. Just have to let it calm down and bring it home. Nothing has happened. You haven't disappeared. But you know, it's so helpful is to notice if you are having problems with your mind, is to notice your presence in the midst of the problem. Because it is not, there's no distance between yourself and the problematic mind. There's no distance at all. There's no distance between yourself and the happy mind, and there's no distance between yourself and the problematic mind. You just have to notice. You need the viveka. It's not that the problem mind that's causing you pain. There's pain there, and that's not the nicest thing to have to experience. But yourself, whole and complete, is there, holding that pain. That's why if you can do the viveka, when that painful mind is there, then the mind has someone present to it that's not in pain. So actually that's a good time to notice that. Your pain becomes like a sadhana. Okay, so we're going to have class Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday. Then I'm going to India.